time left over, I'd love to hear some of those that or maybe some thoughts on some of these things. But the first book I'd like to talk to you about is Mission to the Headhunters. This was a book, I was cleaning closets and I came across this book. I don't know where it came from, how long I've had it, but I thought, I'm going to read this book. And it was truly an exciting book. This is written by a missionary who was in Ecuador before and after the time of the five missionaries that were killed by the Aucas, Jim Elliot. And it's been a long time since I've read those biographies, and so I'm not sure how long they were actually involved in the mission group. Jim Elliot was a pilot that came in. But these missionaries lived there for 37 years amongst these very, very primitive people. This is a little bit of a description of what this was like. I had seen for myself how he'd taken a survey flight over this area. I had seen for myself how hard was the daily existence of the missionary couple now living there, how much it took out of them just to survive, to feed themselves, to fight against ill health, to communicate with a strange race that had no written language. I had learned something of the primeval custom that held the Jivaro Indians in their spell, the dark ways of witchcraft, of the murderous and constant warfare, of the grisly practice of hunting and shrinking heads. Looking down, I was awed by the vastness of that great ocean of trees, the rivers cut so clearly through the beautiful map below. But I knew that the smooth carpet of leaves was only a camouflage that hid the tangled and turning trails beneath, the steep ascents and descents, the swamps and the seas of mud. It also hid the evil forces of evil at work in the hearts of the Jivaros. Would we ever be able to prevail against these long entrenched powers of darkness? I tried to get it into perspective. I thought of the ant and what he has to overcome to crawl a half a mile with his load of leaves. The big log he climbs, but seems like a mountain. He climbs, he falls, he climbs again, but he never gives up. The area that they lived in, to go from one village to the next village could be a three-day trek through that jungle to where there was someone else, there was a mission station. He says, the stories of the Jivaros themselves were enough to daunt the most daring adventure seekers. We wondered if we would be able to make friends with and live among such Indians as these. Though outsiders call them Jivaros, we read that they call themselves Shuaras, the term meaning the people. They must have been among the most primitive and savage tribes left on earth. They must have been among the last, too, to follow the practice of head hunting and head shrinking. The blackened, shrunken head of an enemy hung inside the door of the conqueror was a valued talisman called a tsansa. We tried to picture how it would be to live with Indians who had taken part in shrinking an enemy's head. One chapter, he just goes into the whole detail of how they did that. But it's an exciting book, clear to the end of the many years and building strips for the airplanes to come in, and when there was trying to just reach those people that had such strong customs and to be able to convey to them the meaning of the gospel in a language, you know, a brand new language that they had to learn while they were there. So that, as you'll notice on your sheet, I've found where they're all available. You're all familiar with CBD and Amazon. Anyone doesn't know what that means? This is where I check the availability on them. The next book I'd like to look at is this. I've had this book a while, but I'd found it on a 99-cent special. Anticipations. This is a book for single women. And she says here, Anticipations, it sounds like one of those words you've heard before, but you're not quite sure. As far as I know, it is original. I came up with a word during a time in my life when I was struggling to understand how to wait both patiently and expectantly for God to provide me with the desires of my heart, a husband. Suddenly, it hit me that I couldn't be expectant without being patient. And patience without expectations isn't really patience at all. It's lost hope. And then she... she said, in our introduction to the concept of anticipations, we briefly look at faith. Faith is an issue with enormous implications for any Christian. Essentially, faith is conviction about the truthfulness of God. As I read this book, she said, you know, there's a lot of women, she pick up a book on single living and, you know, you look at the author and you know, she's married and she's got kids and what does she know about it? This woman lived, I don't know how old she was when she wrote this, but she was yet to find her mate. But she said it's not wrong to live in the expectation of getting married. Too often single girls, they're counseled, well, you know, just be content with your life and go on. And it is a sense of hopelessness, though they learn to go ahead and minister and do the things that single girls do. But the whole while, it's okay. It's an okay thing to hope for that thing that you truly desire. And God did create women to be wives. And one of the things that was a blessing to me in this book is that that she was so biblical in her approach and her walk of faith and hope and trust that I found it applying to many aspects in my life. Whether you were a single girl or not, this book ministered to your heart in learning to just trust God, to walk with Him. She said, she quotes the scripture, though the flock may be cut off from the fold and there be no herds in the stall, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Here is one of the strongest manifestations of faith in Scripture. Yet. It is such a tiny word, but its implications are enormous. It means nevertheless or however. The prophet Habakkuk understood its significance. He painted a scenario of a barren land, no blossoms, no fruit, no food, no flocks, no cattle, nothing. His use of that tiny word yet, however, reveals his awesome faith in God, the provider in spite of the overwhelming odds. And I just really appreciated all that she shared in that book in that regard. The next book was just kind of a fun, encouraging book. Fun. It's called Baby Changes Everything. This is we're living in a society where women are getting married later and later in life. They're having children later and later in life. And this is for the woman who is pregnant after 35. She says here, if you're a pregnant woman after 35 or older, you know how the medical community labels us, advanced maternal age, AMA. As far as I'm concerned, those three words are just another way of saying I'm old. So I'm replacing AMA with a new phrase, mommy come lately. Let me explain. My term mommy come lately is closely related to the old term Johnny come lately. If you rush to look up that term in your dictionary, you may not even find that newer version in Merriam-Webster's. Not many people use it anymore. So what is it? A Johnny come lately is someone who has only recently started a job or activity and has suddenly become very successful. Put a maternal spin on that, late in life motherhood, and you now have a mommy come lately. an older, successful mom. There are all types of mommies come lately. Women who choose to wait to have children while they pursued education and careers. Women who were surprised by late-in-life pregnancy. Women who adopted children in their mid-30s or 40s. Women who battled infertility or chronic illness to become pregnant. Women who became mothers in their 20s and continued to have children into their 40s. Women who remarried and became a late-in-life mom in a blended family. I designate myself as a repeater mommy come lately. My fourth child was born 12 years after my third. My friend Mary is a first-timer whose only child was born when Mary was 46. I wrote this book for moms like Mary and me. And she points out every baby makes you a new mom. No matter how many you've had before, each one is a new situation. And this is just a book of encouragement. You know, you're not alone in your situation in life. And so that was an interesting book and fun to read. And I have no plans. Okay. We are living in a very different world than what, you know, I have some books here that growing up in, you know, when I raised my girls, and I never would have considered any of these books. We raised our girls in pretty much a pretty sheltered Christian community. But, you know, we are not in that sheltered Christian community anymore. And some of these books that I have, you might not need for your family, but you're going to have people coming into your churches that do not have the foundation that we had growing up. You might have family members, young people in your family that do not have the same kind of Christian input, that some of these books I think you'll find valuable. Let's see. The next one is called Thin Enough. This is a book on anorexia, bulimia. This is a serious problem especially amongst teenage girls. They look at the society around them, all their models, the advertisements, everything is, here is this perfectly shaped, thin, beautiful somebody. And they feel that's what they need to become. Some girls walk into this because of a lot of emotional issues in the home they grew up in. But some walk into it kind of innocently, trying to be something else. This particular book, this girl shares her life, you know, as a teenager and the struggles that she went through. It is all the way through, there's scripture and things that she is learning. But she did not find victory over it until the very end of the book when she trusted Christ. And that satisfied the longing of her heart that she'd been searching to fill and to meet. It really helps you understand the mindset of girls like this and why they're doing what they're doing. Oftentimes, tied into the diet restriction is exercise, very compulsive, driving exercise to have that perfect body. She says it was 12 o'clock midnight and the alarm blared. "Get up, you must do this," yelled a voice from somewhere deep within me. Slowly rising from my bed, I avoided the lightheaded dizziness and concentrated on every movement. Already exhausted, I began this day, as I did most others, with a collapsing spell. Thud. How many calories are burned in a drop? Thud, anyway, I thought to myself as I accepted the collapse as part of my routine. It was merely the price I had to pay to be 19 years old, 5'4" tall, and 80 pounds. That kind of thinness wouldn't happen unless I made it happen. I obeyed my inner drill sergeant and stumbled in the dark to my exercise equipment. In the beginning, I had enjoyed the sense of accomplishment, the toned body, and the natural endorphin high that exercise brought me. Somehow, that had morphed into the morning installment of my daily punishment. Driven by fear, I believed my critical inner voice when it told me such things as, "No one will ever want you unless you're thin, beautiful, and perfect, you know. You're not good enough. Who do you think? You're kidding by doing this, but you better not stop. You have to finish this. You won't be able to live with yourself if you don't." The next 6 punishing hours became a thud fest. I tried to find the emotional strength to deal with my inner commandments, orders, and enough physical strength to keep from fainting again. Collapsing was inevitable, though. I saw it as the price I needed to pay for the perfection and worth. It's sad that that's what girls go through, to think that that makes them acceptable. And I know there's been times when counselors at campus had campers like this. And I just looked up some statistics on eating disorders, and it says that 42% of first through third grade girls want to be thinner. They see the published image. 81% of 10-year-olds are afraid of being fat. And of course, you know, Mrs. Obama hasn't helped anything by, you know, all this, you know, everybody's conscious of being fat. Well, the book really gives a lot of insight. And if you know someone who's struggling, she really gives a good spiritual input here in where the real source of beauty comes from the Lord. There's another book that I got at the same time. I don't really recommend it because it really doesn't have much spiritual perspective to it, but it just helped me see more fully the picture. And it was called Life Inside the Thin Cage. And this was written, she said she was not anorexic, she was not bulimic, and so she just didn't quite fit into the categories that are normally considered the psychotic problems. But it's about control of being a chronic dieter. And there's a lot of women today that live under chronic dieting, the yo-yo dieting, there's just being consumed with your appearance. Now, ladies, I know we're all concerned about our appearance. You know, we're careful about what we pick out, what we're going to wear when we get dressed in the morning. We step on the scale and see if we're adding those extra pounds. I do that. You know, we're women and we're concerned about our appearance. But this is an overconsumption of feeling like I have to be thin. But yet, because it's a chronic yo-yo dieting, you know, there's a putting on a weight and then losing weight, and it's constantly focused on diet all the time and eating and never being able to just live a normal, balanced life. Sometimes you'll see people who say, well, I just watch what I eat, you know, and they don't feel like they could come, you know, like a time like this and just enjoy, appreciate what's being served. But chronic yo-yo dieting is so common and accepted that little is discussed about the grip it has on so many people's lives. We are inundated in the grocery store with pictures of celebrities promoting their latest diet successes and telling us how we too can lose unwanted pounds and inches. But no one talks about the fears of those movie stars were going through that led them to their latest diet. It says that from a physical standpoint, chronic dieting has been related to late onset diabetes, irritable bowel syndrome, constipation, fatigue, and other serious conditions. Finally, life is often chaotic and depressed for those trapped in the chronic dieting. The dieter's world centers on food and eating, so there's little no priority given to other people. Relationships suffer, leading to feelings of inadequacy, unworthiness, and helplessness. And she talked about just being trapped in that thin cage. It's a mindset. I read that that ladies in this category end up, your anorexia, bulimia, it is life-threatening. Girls die from that. There's a lot of serious things that come from that. But they say more end up dying from this mindset than the other. But again, that is, if it's something that you can read for your own resources, I don't feel like it helps them as much to find the solutions. This particular girl, she had a normal childhood growing up. Is when she went to college, a Christian college, and all of a sudden that freshman 15, you ever heard of that? The 15 pounds you gained when you first year at school, that's where she started. It all started her pattern because she put on this weight suddenly and had to lose it, and then just led to the problems that she had. The next one that I have, Teenology. Again, this is not a book that I would give to someone who has their little Christian bubble of a home. But again, we have a lot of, you know, this is reaching, this is a brand new book. I don't know when the year that was. But this is to the teenager with the iPods and the telephones and the Facebook and all those things that are going on in their lives, and the importance of parents to really know what your kids are doing and to take proper control of it. He says, I'm afraid too many parents have indulged and enabled their children to such an extent that they have helped create irresponsible and even narcissistic kids. When we have weak, inconsistent discipline and poor boundaries, kids just aren't willing to grow up. This doesn't mean teens shouldn't be nurtured and affirmed, though. Every teen needs parents who can irrationally be positive towards them. Yet at the same time, they need us to express expectations, set high standards, and hold them accountable. In other words, our kids need us to lead. One of the things that he recommends in here, and he recognizes that the teenage world that we have today, teens are kind of their own bosses because that's what our world has created. And there's a lot of teens that's, you can't just set a mark and tell them to do it and they're going to do it. And he talks about the importance of having them help you create the standard. As they help you create the standard, then they're more inclined, okay, this is what I know I need to live by, and therefore I am going to, you even have your teen help set, okay, what are the consequences when I fail to meet up to my end of the bargain? And he says, parents sometimes need such a tool as this family contract. Shame-based parenting never works in the long haul, and preaching, criticizing, and yelling are never effective as motivating. They tend to close your child's spirit toward you. With a contract, however, children learn to discipline themselves and become more obedient. It's a parent's job to maximize character and responsibility, and we do that best by evoking discipline and boundaries. Responsible and obedient kids are the happiest kids. By and large, most teens do want to succeed and, believe it or not, please their parents. And so this is, it's a real positive way of, but it's, you know, it says, you know, you're not going to be able to shut your kids out of all these things that are going on if that's what they're exposed to. But just really taking full grips of of the right kinds of controls for that. There's one gal that I frequently that will call me for counsel sometimes, and she's got a teenage son that I said, get one of these books. It'll really help you in just dealing with them, because that's where her kids are. They're out in this world where they're living amongst all of these influences. Another book that would not be for someone who's grown up in the church, Facing Your $1 Million Mate. It's a very basic, really, but it's focused to that college student or post-college, early 20s, who is just doing the dating scene, trying to find someone to marry. And you probably have someone in your family like that, you know, that they're not looking at things from a spiritual perspective. They're looking at how pretty she is, or, you know, very superficial things. And he talks about, you know, when you're looking at just superficial things, then we have a marriage that lasts 2 years and it's broken up. And so it's a real easy read, but he helps them, you know, if you want a marriage that's going to be a $1 million marriage, a marriage that's going to last, he helps them to look at it what are the spiritual values that's going to create a long-lasting marriage. He says here, sadly, there's nothing real about reality TV, especially in the dating craze. A journalist writing for the Christian Science Monitor interviewed a group of singles as they watched back-to-back episodes of the Wild Dating Games. Just all that's put out there on how to date, how to find a mate, is just so misleading to young people that don't have anything else to guide their choices on. Then a book I picked up at camp at the couples retreat. Kim, have you read this book? It's When Sinners Say I Do. I thought this book, you know, for marriages that have issues and are struggling, it is a tremendous book. It doesn't deal with submission, and, you know, it doesn't talk about all the things that you typically read out of, you know, a Christian marriage. But how do you have a right biblical relationship? The contents. I ran out of time and I didn't get this one tagged. But talks about the reality, showing mercy, showing grace, all the Christian virtues in your relationship with people. What is forgiveness? Living in forgiveness. And then it talks about... you know, sometimes there's situations that are beyond, and there's no justification for that. But a lot of times, problems arise in the physical aspect of marriage, and he at the end of the book he hits that head on, and which you don't often find in books. The way he deals with that, and it's interesting. I never thought about it before, but he says, here's the Apostle Paul, and I thought, you know, Apostle Paul was a single man. He wasn't married, but yet in Corinthians, he takes that physical relationship and just really lays it on the line for what it should be. And Corinth was the most wicked sexual city in that part of the world, the corruption that was there, and it was part of the church, and so you know, Paul really deals with it, and so I really encourage you to get that book for anyone who is really struggling in their marriage relationship. And this book, you know, as you read it, just like the book on anticipation. And this is a book that applies to all kinds of areas of life. You can read through that. You might not be having marriage problems, but it really helps you in just your dealing with relationships with people all the way through that book. And then the last two books that I have on my list is books that were published by in our own fundamental circles. We don't have a whole lot of books like that, but this book was What to Do When You're Abused by Your Husband, A Biblical Perspective. This was put out by Camp Ironwood. Why was it put out by Camp Ironwood? Because this is a serious problem in our fundamental Christian churches. It is sometimes the abusive husband is the highly respected deacon in the church or whatever. You know, and a couple years ago there was big scandals about a pastor where there was abuse going on. But the abuse, particularly abuse of wives, sometimes it's verbal abuse. And, you know, years ago I didn't think too much about verbal abuse, you know. Sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but words will never harm me. You know, isn't that what you grew up with? Well, any woman ought to be able to deal with verbal abuse because you're not being hurt physically. Verbal abuse is very devastating. It just totally crushes the spirit, and it can do great harm. And what is the problem? Why is it so strong in our fundamental churches? What is the woman taught? Submit to your husband. If you have a sweet spirit, well, you can turn the heart of your husband. Isn't that what we're taught? So many times girls think, well, if I can just be a better wife, things will be different. Every day waking up, well, now, if I do this a little differently, I can please him, and the abuse will stop. It doesn't work that way because we are in a very degenerate society, and we have men in Christian homes that have grown up not knowing how to be godly men. And they come into marriage, and, you know, you meet this handsome young man on a Christian campus, and you think all's right with the world, and we're going to live happily ever after, and it doesn't always happen that way. And so one of the things in this book is written to those who would counsel women like this, because what happens when a woman goes to a pastor and says, my husband's being abusive? You know, one reaction is, oh, well, no, you know, why, he's just Mr. Right in the church. Well, you know, it must not be really the way she's making it sound. And number two is, well, you're not doing your job. You're not being sweet and submissive enough. And here it says, to those who would counsel someone like this, do not blame the abuser's anger on marriage problems, circumstances, or other people, including his wife. The sins which have become habituated in the abuser are so well honed and so deeply ingrained that, with rare exception, the single most difficult aspect of counseling an abuser is a task of instrumentally helping him face, admit, and biblically deal with his own sin. It is pointless to try to deal with sin problems in the marriage relationship until the abuser is willing to deal with his own sins first. When Patty was urged Ellen to go to her pastor for help with a problem, she was reluctant, fearing Jim would carry out his threat to leave her if she did so. She also feared that her pastor would not believe her because Jim had been a deacon in the church for years and everyone in the congregation knew him, thought he was a model Christian. No, concluded Ellen, I can't risk embarrassing my husband because Jim has never actually hit me. And there is a, it's kind of one of those hidden sins in the church, and as women, they live with it for years silently because you don't want to speak against your husband. You're loyal to your husband. But what is the impact of abuse on a wife? The degree to which the husband has managed to isolate his wife, not only from others but from truth itself, tends to increase her internal struggles as she experiences abuse, as she seeks to make sense out of what has happened or is happening on a daily basis. She may have had great difficulty discerning the reality of her husband's manipulation and abuse because she has no one else with whom she can test her perceptions. Where no counsel is, people fall, but in the multitude of counselors there is safety. A woman needs to be able to go to someone to keep, to encourage her, to help her look at things biblically, to look at things right. Generally, her emotional state becomes such that reading scripture offers little comfort because she immediately convinces herself that she is not interpreting a passage correctly if it offers her hope and direction. If the husband is a professing Christian, he will probably reinforce her uncertainty by suggesting she is incompetent in discerning scripture or is in rebellion against scripture and therefore rejected by God because she hasn't been submissive enough, and they twist scripture, they twist, they're usually very, very skilled with their words to twist situations. The very last book is much more positive. And this again is from, this is from Camp Joy that was put out, and a friend gave this book to me. And thinking about our conference this weekend on music, this is Music Investigation. It is a, it's a 30-day Bible study of helping you just go through what does Scripture say about music. It's a good study for teenagers to help them study, do their own, you know, okay, this is what Scripture says, how we're going to apply it, and to build their own convictions on a personal study that they have. They're not just reading another book, but they're looking it up and studying and evaluating that. And I appreciate someone that, you know, to take this. The only problem with this book is that it's $15, which makes it kind of expensive for a Bible study. But if you were wanting to do this with a group of teenagers or whatever, maybe you could call them and get a group price or something that that would be good. But I talked to Tim Fisher about the, this is available through a group called Grace for All Publications. And they are a group in, I think he said, West Virginia? I don't know, somewhere between here and Greenville they're located. And they publish a lot of Christian books on music, books with help you evaluate high standards, and they also publish their own octavo music. And he says the music that they write is good music, but it is on a simple level that for the small church that's not high, doesn't have the high training or you know, all the musical resources, they have a lot of good music available. So I would love to have some feedback, questions, or books that you would want to offer, but it's 4:30, and I'm going to let Jenny turn over to Jenny.